welcome again to Cinema Squabble, episode number 9. Who are we? What do we do? Well, we are a number of Seattle's film critics, and we've been gathering in theaters at press screenings for years, discussing what we think is great and what we think is absolutely horrible, and now we bring it to you in podcast form. My name is Adam Gerke. Joining me at the table right now, Sarah Michelle Fetters from Seattle Gay News and MovieFreak.com.
Howdy, howdy.
Also, Brian Zitzelman of The Examiner.
That's me.
And a very special guest this afternoon, whenever you may be listening, Mr. Carl Spence, the artistic director of the Seattle International Film Festival. Carl, welcome.
Yes, I'm here. Very excited.
Yeah.
Let's hear the voice. Come on.
So, yeah, exactly. So this is who we've gathered. This is who we've assembled. A number of films coming out. We want to talk to Carl specifically about all things SIFF momentarily. But Carl also, of course, a cinephile himself, will have his chance to weigh in on a number of these films we're going to be talking about here as well. So from the get-go, well, let's talk about
Adult Beginners.
This opening actually at SIFF this Friday. Is that correct? Am I getting that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
It's opening on Friday.
So Adult Beginners, I'm just going to read right off of this here. Young hipster entrepreneur played by comedian Nick Kroll. He actually crashes, burns. He's trying to do a startup with a big company launch. The entire life has fallen into disarray, though, because he loses everything, loses all of his friends' finances, leaves Manhattan, moves in with his estranged and pregnant sister, played by Rose Byrne, and brother-in-law, Bobby Cannavale. And they also happen to have a 3-year-old nephew living in the suburbs, happens to be Kroll's old house from when he was a child, and he's forced to become their nanny, but then also forced to discover himself and try and right his ship before the whole thing falls apart. Where do we sit on this? Sarah, you had a chance to see this with me on this.
I kind of felt like it flatlined, to be honest.
And why do you say it flatlined?
Well, it just doesn't do anything with the premise. It just doesn't go anywhere that I was all that interested. I think, once again, Rose Byrne proves she's not just one of the more talented comedians out there. She's one of the more talented actresses flat out working today.
Mm-hmm.
She's got moments in here that just took my breath away, both funny, sad. I mean, the whole gamut. I think she's great.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Cannavale has a couple nice moments. Nick Kroll is okay. I just wasn't interested. Uh-huh. I didn't care. And because I didn't care, I had no interest in seeing where everything was going.
Oh, okay. Because I, on the other hand, did get involved with Kroll's character and found him to be, you know, funny off and on. And in fact, was just recently here in Seattle stumping the film and set it up brilliantly, I guess, outside of the film. So that's outside of his performance. But known for being a funny guy, manages to pull off a number of great gags and bits. And I found it to be entertaining. So
he has a bit of a sketch comedy background.
Yes.
So I unfortunately wasn't able to see the movie yet. What's the comedic tone for this? I mean, it sounds from the concept, it sounds like it's a little bit Happy Christmas. It's a little bit of a kind of Noah Baumbach thing. Does it have that dramatic weight, or is it more like a sketch show, which is very goofy, very wild?
I think it wants to have that emotional, character-driven weight of a Noah Baumbach or a Joe Swanberg movie, but it's so sketchy and it's so all over the map that it just, for me, it just never connects. It never comes home, and I couldn't get that emotional attachment to it that would want me to see where this character goes and how his journey ends.
Okay.
And I just love the characters and the actors, because Bobby Cannavale is one of my favorite, as well as Rose Byrne. And I don't know if you knew that they're playing, you know, a married couple, and they actually are a married couple. They're also featured in another film called Spy, which is sort of a completely different movie, which I'm jumping across.
But that's okay.
I know, but
the boundaries.
And we'll get to Spy in a second, sort of.
But I don't know, maybe it's more of a popcorn film that, you know, you need to drink a few glasses of wine before you can enjoy fully.
A wine film.
Which you can do, I hear, at the SIFF Uptown and the SIFF Egyptian.
That is true. You can have multiple glasses of wine.
Okay, yeah. So all right, very briefly then, Sarah, where do you sit on this? Theater, rent, or skip on this one for you?
For Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale, I would say rent.
Okay. And you know what? I'm going to say, for the fun activity, that we've got a number of great things out this weekend, but because if you're not into all things Avengers and whatnot, I'd give it a theater for the fun sake of it, out of the pure fact on that. And Brian, unfortunately,
it's your Adam qualifier.
Yeah, it's the qualifier.
You know, if you have a couple bucks, but not too many bucks,
yeah.
Carl's saying,
a squabbler. He's seen it. Okay. What do you say?
I'd say it's worth a shot. I mean, if you're a fan of Nick Kroll, you should definitely see it. And if you're a member of SIFF, you get a pretty good discount. So, you know, a couple bucks, not too bad.
There you go. And Carl even said you have a glass of wine to go with it, too. So that makes it all the better. That brings us to The Clouds of Sils Maria.
The Clouds of Sils Maria is a new film from French filmmaker Olivier Assayas, who's made some of the great films that you've seen in these last,
20
years. But, I mean, Carlos, Summer Hours, Irma Vep, Clean, these are borderline masterpieces. Mm-hmm. Clouds of Sils Maria is up there with some of the best things he's ever made, in my opinion. It's about a 40-year-old actress, Maria, played by Juliette Binoche, who discovers she's about to be basically replaced by younger versions of herself, mm-hmm. Chloe Grace Moretz. She's going to be in a play that she was the ingenue in 20 years prior. Now she's playing the older part. And so she goes...
So life imitates art, yeah, or art imitates life.
Exactly. And she's going to go off on a short, small little mountain retreat with her assistant, Valentine, played by Kristen Stewart. This sounds deceptively simple.
And Kristen Stewart, known for being one note.
Well,
by you.
Well, maybe Once Upon a Time.
Yeah. Kristen Stewart, who just became the first American actor ever, period, to win the French Caesar Award.
Mm-hmm. César.
César, thank you.
Sorry. I'd like to win a Caesar Award, too, but I think that's pizza.
Oh, Adam, you sound less convinced with this movie, perhaps. Am I reading you wrong?
Well, so here's the thing about it. I think it is a great movie. I think there's a lot that it really can stand on. And here's what I liked about it first. I like the fact that throughout the film, we're seeing Stewart reading to Binoche, having her practice her lines as she's prepping for this role. And having read with a number of actors over the years where they say, here, read these lines for me. And it really did take on that kind of... are you playing that character or are you being you? And so there's always that question when a really good actor is really embodying that character, because it kind of leaves you questioning. And they do that.
And the movie introduces some of those scenes where you don't know if they're in context of restaging the or practicing lines.
Exactly.
Or this is actually.
Yeah, so you're sitting there questioning, going, well, wait a minute. Is this the character being the character or is this the character? So I thought that was fantastic. I thought that was spot on. Where Sarah's very excited about Kristen Stewart, I am less enthused. I just kind of go, well, yeah, it's a good performance, but okay. I mean, I could see a lot of folks doing
this. You think it's one note still?
I don't think it's a one note, okay. But I'm not as in love with this performance as Sarah's per se.
Oh, I think she's genius in this film. I also thought she was genius in Camp X-Ray last year. I thought she was borderline fantastic in Still Alice. If that movie had given her more to do, I think she would have been definitely fantastic in that last year. I have no problem with her winning this award from the French. And if there's any justice, I think both her and Binoche should be remembered by Oscar at the end of the year. Sadly, based on the kind of movie this is, mm-hmm. it probably will not happen.
Carl?
Well, I'm, Kristen Stewart, I don't know, I'm still a bit tainted by what she's done before, although I actually have to give her, a lot of credit for the types of roles she's taking, because she definitely is not following the traditional path. But this film, I don't know, she didn't really do much for me, actually. Juliette Binoche had a bit more of emotion that I sort of connected to in terms of the part. I really felt that Kristen Stewart was more flat, but then again, was that the character she was playing? Mm-hmm. Some people really got off on it. The French also have a very interesting idea of what is great sometimes, I think. Yeah. So, and normally I'd love what the French think. Normally I love what the French think is great and really connect to that, but... But I know I was actually very surprised that she won a César for this role, because I sort of wrote it off when I saw it.
Oh, okay.
I think we can all agree, though, that Binoche is phenomenal in this movie.
Absolutely. I don't know how we can disagree with that.
I mean, she's a goddess. I mean, you could make a safe argument that she's in the running for the best working actor, actress alive today. I don't see any reason to think otherwise. And I do think the movie's pretty just fantastic from beginning to end. I mean, I'm on the, it will probably be, if there's 10 better movies this year, this is going to be a pretty fantastic year. I mean, I'm in the bag for SAS anyways, but I think it hits from beginning to end. There's so many nice little notes. Like one of the nice things with, I think where Stewart opens up a little bit more is there's a conversation she's having with Binoche's character after they watch a superhero blockbuster movie. And she's trying to explain, mm-hmm. The depth. I mean, they don't really say that Kristen Stewart's character is innately a nerd, but she's trying to say like how superhero things and superpowers can have mm-hmm. extra layers to them and be parables. And Binoche is just laughing it off.
She's not having it at
and
all.
And it's a really terrific scene. It shows how Binoche's character, Maria, can be a bit off-putting. They don't paint her always in the nicest light, but they're also not painting her to be just kind of a straight-up shrew about it. And that Stewart gets very annoyed bit by bit. But you see the relationship. You see how the mm-hmm. bond has grown and has some tension there as well. As she gets annoyed, understands, gets annoyed again, I mean, it's just one of the many fantastic scenes. It's gorgeous looking. I mean, the scene where the clouds.
Yeah, the actual snake.
The titular clouds. Yeah, the snake Majola, I believe is what it's pronounced. When that finally comes in with the classical music, it's stunning stuff. And Esaias is not someone who, other than Carlos, Something in the Air, a lot of his movies like something like Summer Hours are very plainly shot.
Mm-hmm.
This is a moment in that movie to elevate that.
Okay. And so if there's a weakness, other than what we've already stated, Brian, do you see anything?
Nope. If I have to nitpick,
mm-hmm.
maybe Chloe Grace Moretz isn't great in it.
Hmm.
She's fine. I'm not particularly a fan of hers, but she fits the billing of it enough of kind of a, I guess, a Lindsay Lohan-esque.
I was going to say, she's a Lindsay Lohan,
she's, and even that, and again, that brings in another great scene where Maria is just disappointed that she's going to have to work with this younger actress, and she just gets off on watching YouTube clips
mm-hmm.
of Chloe Grace Moretz's character messing everything up, screwing up her lines, not even remember the things that she's working with at interviews.
But even that seems to be an act put on because, I mean, it's all for the show.
But isn't that the great thing about Esaias's films in that they're never really about what you think they're going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
They're always so much more complex and so much more internal, and there's so much going on underneath the surface that even in one viewing, it's impossible to capture it all.
Well, I really need to revisit it because I saw it 6 months ago, and it was actually one of 10 films I saw that day. So it was I feel like that I wasn't ready really in the spot to absorb what I was seeing. And didn't appreciate it, but at the same time, it's hard to go back and revisit. You know,
and it's not like Esaias isn't a fan of Sif. I mean, how many of his films have we shown here?
Almost all of them.
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's the way to do it.
I'm a fan of his. So it's
isn't he a former emerging master?
Yes.
Okay, so that being said, theater, rent, skip. Sarah?
I'm with Brian. I don't know how I see 10 better films than this year, so I'm going to go theater times 10.
Okay. All right. So we've got a theater. Carl, you're sitting here in the middle.
I'm always theater.
Okay. Carl always being in the theater. And Brian?
I'm an atheist, but Esaias is a god theater.
Okay. And I will say rent on this one purely out of the fact that I am not as in love with the performance, although I do think Binoche is fantastic.
People are booing you.
On a mass appeal factor,
I don't see this.
It works for the cinephiles.
Is there a time of day you should rent this? Is there a certain cost? Like Netflix rents it?
You're being awfully definitive here, Adam. I don't know about this.
Well, make sure you're well rested. Let's say that.
But Brian, speaking of superhero conversations.
I know. Speaking of
Is there something going on this week?
So Avengers Age of Ultron is the latest superhero behemoth from Disney's Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's following up 2012's Avengers. Once more, brings together Captain America, Iron Man, Black Widow, Thor, your mom, my cat, Mr. Bear, all those people.
Mm-hmm.
Are the Chatty Catties in
it? The Chatty Catties.
Don't forget Hawkeye. He's kind of an important person here.
In a way. This time out, the good guys are on a united front. They're taking on Ultron, a robot gone very, very bad. Ultron was created by Tony Stark, Iron Man, which is, again, nobody's different in the casting this time, but once more, it's still Robert Downey Jr. He's trying to create Ultron to be like a worldwide defender. So if things go wrong, the Avengers can't handle it, or if the Avengers are busy, there's this kick-ass robot who's going to fight all the bad guys for them.
Mm-hmm.
It'll create peace in our time. That's mm-hmm. the phrase they keep using time and again. Instead of going all Wally on mankind and singing Hello Dolly with Hawkeye, this mm-hmm. robot tries to kill everybody.
Yeah.
Doesn't particularly work out. Joss Whedon, who did the last film, he's from Buffy, did Serenity, Firefly, helped write Cabin in the Woods. He's writing Woo-hoo! And directing again. And it has all the quips, and it is the most marveliest Marvel movie that ever marveled. So there's the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then there's, you know, X-Men Marvel, there's Fantastic Four Marvel.
Uh-huh.
The Marvel movies are in a good and bad rut. All of the qualities that we've come to expect from their movies, the quippy dialogue, uh-huh. the good ensembles,
the Stan Lee performance.
The Stan Lee cameo that uh-huh. is almost annoying now, but I guess, you know, it's kind of part of it. Those are all there. They're fun with a butt, and the butts remain. The score is still pretty boring and forgettable. The ending still includes a bunch of our heroes fighting something big in the sky that's threatening the end of the world.
Uh-huh.
And the villain is still not good. Am I wrong, Adam? Did you? So Ultron's the baddie. Is Ultron a good villain?
Here's what I... Correct me if I'm wrong on this.
I will correct
when you. When you see Ultron for the very first time... Very first time he appears.
Which is a great scene.
It is
not
a great...
Not the glowy thing, but the physical form.
The physical form of him in the form of the, kind of the robot-y thing.
Broken down robot.
Who did you think of the instant you saw and heard that very first appearance?
I don't know. Nothing popped out of me, Sarah.
What, the first appearance?
The very first appearance.
What did I think?
Who did you think of?
Who did I think of? I thought of James Spader just because James Spader's playing him and...
I immediately thought of Heath Ledger. And I thought of...
Oh, interesting.
I immediately thought of
The
Joker's first appearance in front of the mobsters and the gangsters. When he first pulls into the... and he does the pencil
trick. He's monologuing.
Yeah, he does this. I saw that and I was like, oh my God. If ever there was an homage to Heath Ledger, this is it.
Yeah, and he's all broken down.
Broken
he's
down.
Beaten down and he's...
He's even got the posture.
Yeah, the posture.
Of the Joker.
You're right.
So,
okay.
And to that which... I loved it. I thought, wow, this is a great... homage being done here almost on the nose in many regards. And I was curious if anybody else picked up.
I didn't pick up on that.
But I think the introduction of the villain is fantastic because it's when all of the heroes are sort of relaxing. They've just had this great, wonderful comrade moment where they're trying to lift Thor's hammer. It's kind of awesome.
It's goofy. It's great. Yeah.
But they're not ready for it. And he puts them to the test immediately, and it makes him seem like he's going to be this really giant, deadly threat.
Hmm.
And then the movie doesn't do anything with it, ever.
See, I thought it was great, though, because he has to scurry away, build his powers, and then come back.
Yeah, but he could have probably destroyed them there.
But is he interesting? Is he a good... He has a good introduction. Sure, I'm not entirely on that because I think they may jump to it a little too quick. But that scene after the party is good. Is he a good villain altogether? Because in the end, I find him a little quippy, a little
because he's
generic in his motive.
He's the child of Tony Stark, so he's gonna have some quirky.
I get that he is the reincarnation to an extent of his hubris. But he's also just another quippy guy. There's no real menace. You know, you can't half expect him to throw out some like Big Lebowski quotes or get all meta and talk about the fact that he's being meta. He's just there. There's no threat.
Well, especially because other characters end up either vertently or inadvertently talking about how they're being meta.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah. Renner again. Yeah.
And he has this army of, you know, other robots that they send after him. But I mean... I understand these movies have your standard extra baddies, the kind of sidekicks that are just going to get beat up, but it does seem like little kids with little things on their arms to keep them, little floaty devices, they could beat these robots. So Ultron has to be the ultimate bad guy in this. And his actions might speak to it, but his character just seems like a guy who's trying to have another joke.
See, on the other hand, though, I'm saying, remember, he's trying to do good, but what he sees as good... is actually horrible for us all.
Yeah, but he's doing it in a generic retro 1940s sci-fi sort of way. If we're going to talk about artificial intelligence being scary as hell, let's go watch Ex Machina again and have Ava show up. Ava is a far scarier character and a far more beguiling character and a far more fascinating character than Ultron ever is.
That's true. That's true.
If you'd have taken her and put her in this movie... I think you could have had something kind of extraordinary.
Let's get Garland on the phone. So, okay. So, continuing on this. So, you're not thrilled by Ultron.
I'm not thrilled by Ultron. The movie as a whole is definitely fun. I'm not down on the movie. There are a lot of good scenes. I do think Whedon, the first Avengers, wasn't particularly excellent in terms of action. And some of the scenes here are a little chaotic in a way that doesn't work because they are... I mean, the movie is... overstuffed.
Yeah, but the action sequences that are central to everything, I think, are fantastic. I mean, there's a sequence on a speeding runaway train where the two Maximoff twins and Ultron and Captain America are all forced to face off one against the other. I think that's an extraordinary bit of both visual and visceral action filmmaking where Whedon kind of comes into his own again as this sort of filmmaker.
Yeah, and he actually does something that I know there's been a lot of critiques, and I think fairly, about 9/11 imagery being used in kind of blockbuster cinema of buildings crashing, dust flying everywhere.
And we definitely see one here.
And we definitely see that, but I actually think this is one of the moments, and it doesn't have Ultron per se,
mm-hmm.
where it works. You know, the CGI comes together. Everything feels real. There's Iron Man in his Hulkbuster outfit to stop the Hulk from doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the look of the people, and they are terrified of the things that are going on. I think that's done. A lot of these movies, you see that done, and they run, but it doesn't matter if it's a 100-story building or anything. But here, there's the real terror, and it really helps signify the notion that the Hulk is the menace, to some extent, that Ultron is.
Yeah, but isn't that something, though, that Whedon actually does really well in both Avengers films? These heroes actually care about civilians.
Yeah.
They put the lives of the civilians ahead of everything else.
Just like Vin Diesel in Fast 6.
But surprisingly, but not in Fast 7. Whatever.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
It's like suddenly we don't care about civilians anymore. We're going to just bring down all of London.
So, I know you think some of the things are overstuffed. I know you have, I think Age of Ultron has its qualities.
Yes.
What are some of the issues you have other than Ultron?
Well, I mean, there's maybe 40 minutes of plot in a 2-hour and 20-minute movie.
I mean, that's accurate.
This film is convoluted for the sake of being convoluted, which is the same thing I know I brought up for Furious 7, but that is the fact here. There is not really a lot of movie going on. The threat is, I mean, you could actually put the entire plot of this film into an episode of Buffy. Hey, and you know what? I think Joss Whedon did.
He did, multiple seasons.
On multiple occasions. It just, a lot of this stuff exists just to set up events coming in Marvel movies that we know are already on the docket and coming. You know, we get all of these hints at Captain America Civil War. We get all of these hints at Avengers Infinity War and Avengers Infinity War Part 2. So that gets rid of the tension because we know none of these people can die or get injured or be hurt because they all have to show up in these films happening over the next 5 years.
Well, I don't know how many contracts are still alive out there.
I don't know. Thor's character arc in this movie seems to be an arc to set up future movies.
Yeah, the only reason Thor is in this film is to set up Captain America, Avengers, and Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, so that being the case, where are we sitting on this? Theater, rent, skip, Sarah?
People are going to go see it in the theater, whether I tell them not to or whatever.
Sure.
It's a rental movie.
Okay. Carl, you unfortunately didn't get a chance to see this.
No, I'm waiting for Star Wars.
But you are a theater guy, so we could inadvertently say, Carl, this would
Carl
be a theater.
Says theater.
Carl says theater, so we'll put theater for Carl. And Brian, how about you?
I'm a soft theater.
Soft theater for Brian?
I'm a soft theater.
I'm actually a popcorn at home kind of guy for this movie, I think.
So nice. Carl, you're saying a rental on this.
Yeah.
Carl shifting to rental. Okay.
What a twist.
So
Carl has my back.
Okay. Woo-hoo. And I'm going to say see this one in the theater just because of the spectacle of it.
So don't see it in 3D.
No, that's not worth it.
There's nothing in here. Don't do the IMAX.
In fact, I would say never see anything in 3D these days. It's so blown out of proportion for that very reason. It's just a
Pina. If you can see Pina in 3D.
I agree.
Actually, that was worth it.
Yeah.
When else are you going to see hippopotamus standing
goodbye
in a river?
Goodbye to language. How about that in 3D? Please,
there you go.
Please, please.
Yeah. So, okay.
To
so
totally go
but, you know,
the other way. No Ultron and goodbye to language.
Mm-hmm. But what I think is interesting, guys, is if you look at the two major releases that are hitting this weekend, it's Avengers, it's Clouds of Sils Maria. You could not get any more diametrically opposed as far as to size, scope, whatever.
Right.
As far as two films go.
And what does this speak to?
Well, to me, I think it shows what the state of sort of distribution, the sort of films that Hollywood cares about compared to what independent studios care about. And this is something I think Carl could probably speak to more than any of us in how things, because you've done this for a while now. You've been artistic director over at SIFF for quite a few years. You and I have conversed a number of times, but you've been with SIFF for much longer than that. And you've worked in many other film festivals and in this forum. You've seen this shift that studios now are staying away from a lot of these smaller films and they're only almost specifically interested in these big budget spectacles that play the world over.
And I was thinking something about the fact that last weekend, the biggest film in Seattle was actually Kurt Cobain Montage of Heck, which is an independent film that got released by Universal around the world, but is not getting released in the United States because HBO funded it. So it's got released in three theaters.
Huh.
And
which is wild.
What's
which crazy,
is crazy. And it will be on the big screen for 3 more days. So I'm interested to see how it will fare against Avengers. And but it literally had the highest gross of any theater, and it grossed more than some multiplexes with all 10 or 15 screens combined. So
no
it was
kidding.
Yeah, it's about $60,000.
Wow, that's
so
great.
That's great for an independent film. It also shows the what sort of legendary status Kurt Cobain and the kind of draw he has in terms mm-hmm. of part of our pop culture and people that are really interested in seeing him.
Yeah.
And it's also really interesting in terms of how, you know, an artist has made a film about another artist and how people in Seattle react to it and how the fans reacted versus the people that know him really well, because there's varying degrees of thought in terms of how that movie is, what that movie is and how it, you know, how good it is in terms of who you are and where you were when Kurt Cobain was alive. But independent film, I went completely off your...
It's good.
Not entirely.
But I mean, you know, I look at something like Clouds of Sils Maria or even Adult Beginners, which, you know, Adult Beginners mm-hmm. is getting released by Radius, which is sort of a division of the Weinstein Company. But by and large, other than It Follows, their model is let's release in a few theaters, but do most of our push on VOD.
Yes, and Adult Beginners is actually being released. It's available everywhere as well as in theaters.
Yeah.
It's interesting for us at SIFF that we had Nick Kroll here on Monday, so he was here in person. That was really, you know, the reason why we're showing the film.
Are you seeing a cut perhaps in revenues at all by the VOD phenomenon that's beginning to take over a little bit? Is that impacting the SIFF, I guess, budget?
It's actually been helping us because many of the chains do not want to release some of these films and won't take a risk on a film, say The Snowpiercer, which was in theaters first, but only for a short window, not the full, you know, window that most theaters want. And it was one of our highest grossing films of the year. Same with It Follows, which also we had one of the highest grosses in the country and did quite well. But they actually changed the model where they didn't bring it out on VOD like they had planned because it did so well.
Mm-hmm.
And another one that actually was pretty phenomenal, although it wasn't really, it's actually, I guess I'm pointing out the ones Radius does, some things that are theatrical first and then VOD and then things that are day and date and theatrical. But Citizen 4 is another film from Radius. They do a little bit of both, but they're really sort of experimenting and sort of what works. But for us, those films were some of the best films for us in terms of grosses and finding audiences. What We Do in the Shadows is another independent mm-hmm. film that has huge legs that's been playing with us and other theaters and continues to play and is available in, you know, multiple formats.
And got great marks from all of us who saw it.
Yes.
I have now seen it too. So
very good.
Oh my God, it's fantastic.
So speaking of Citizen 4, I mean, we do seem to be kind of living, maybe not necessarily in an innate golden age of quality for documentaries, not that there aren't bad ones, but there's more awareness of them, definitely in the past 10 years.
So they're more cinematic. I mean, they're more seen as a film versus talking heads. And so there's a much stronger discourse in terms of what a documentary film is and what filmmakers are able to do in terms of how they make those type of films.
Yeah, so when it comes to like planning what you're going to show at SIFF, like have you found yourselves really plotting out which documentaries you want to show, putting them in more prime areas, promoting them more, maybe getting a bigger round amount of those and maybe cutting out standard films?
Well, we've grown the lineup and actually documentaries have sort of pushed their way in and probably pushed some feature films out because we have 70 documentary films in the lineup this year, and we're actually showing more films. So I think we're showing more documentaries just means we're showing more films in general.
But that shows that there's some. I mean, that
we're showing less shorts.
Some, there's
the shorts got short shrift.
I mean, that shows there's some demand for that. I mean,
there's definitely demand. I remember when the documentaries were an anomaly when I first started back in the 90s. That was not a huge part of the lineup. There were some great documentaries, but really it was about the features, and it's changed.
Yeah, it seems like there used to be like the one per year. It was usually the one that would win the Oscar, didn't win the Oscar.
Yeah.
Now there's the whole, oh, have you seen this, the short list for the best picture or the best documentary? It's like, well, those are 15 are good, but what about the 16th, 17th, and 18th?
Yeah, very true. Well, let's talk about SIFF for just a second here, because we've got 450 films. Carl, you know the stats, you know the numbers on all of this. Run us through what you've got kind of lined up this year.
Well, it's interesting that we have more countries than ever before, and it's not by design. We actually just found the best films that we liked and were passionate about and we loved, and then we sort of tallied up them. But I was sort of surprised that we had 92 countries, because I don't know.
That's amazing.
Well, many people don't know that there are actually 92 countries in the world.
And we have another first-time ever country this year, don't we?
From Mauritius. Yes.
Where is Mauritius?
Mauritius.
Ignorant Americans, right?
It's actually a former colony of France, and it's an island.
Oh, okay.
And it's quite beautiful, and I'd like to get there. It just takes 24 hours.
Yeah. Oh, well, there we go.
Is this going to be the first year we have a Chuck Norris movie? Because I see there's the Chuck Norris versus communism documentary.
There's not an actual Chuck Norris movie, but there is a documentary where
Chuck Norris will be in SIF screen.
There's two documentaries that Chuck Norris will be appearing in.
What's the other one?
You've done your homework, because there are two films. There's the film about the history of Canon Films, which is that legendary sort of independent studio of the 80s that made great movies.
Invasion USA. Invasion USA.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And Chuck Norris is a mainstay. It was like they would make a movie and just figure out what Chuck Norris could do and put a title on it.
Yeah.
Missing in Action.
So how do you guys tend to put not to sound like a noob, but how do you put the festival together? I mean, how hard is it to narrow it down? Like, are you guys watching what's coming out of Sundance and getting good reviews, what's coming out of Berlin, trying to pick up stuff that maybe hasn't gotten released theatrically? Are you seeking out filmmakers and saying, you guys have had stuff with us before, do you have something that's nearly done that maybe you want to premiere? What's the general outline?
We do all of that, actually. You just explained most of it.
All right.
We actually.
All right. Next question.
I don't have to say anything. Yeah. It's a year-long process, and we watch a lot of films. We watch over 5,000 films collectively. People send us films unsolicited, and we just will be wowed by something and find it just something that randomly came through the mail. But we do a lot of work in terms of researching films and going out and talking to people about what they know, and then seeing a lot of films. So we do have other programmers that live in other parts of the world, people that focus on specific areas. I'm more of a generalist, so I try to see a little bit of everything and mm-hmm. things that I hear about. But it's a lot of networking. It's a lot of talking to people. It's a lot of watching films. It's a lot of reaching out to producers or filmmakers that we know that they may have a film that we've shown before, and we want to see what their latest film is. Sales agents, distributors. It's sort of a whole mix.
So it's growing. There's more films than ever. Is that a sense of, one, just the festival doing so well? Is that a sense of more places want to show it? Or is that also a sense of
lack of control?
Okay.
That's pretty true. And I mean, we just, you know, we got ahead of ourselves. Sometimes we invited so many movies, they all said yes, and we just had to find a spot for them. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what happened.
So what are some of the films that are standing out to you as like, wow, this is on my list. I saw this. I think this is fantastic.
A polarizing film, which I love, but someone else may have walked out of, is the new Peter Greenaway film, Eisenstein and Guanajuato, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, he's an acquired taste, but he's a provocateur, and he can be very... also, you know, sexually explicit, not afraid to experiment in filmmaking style.
Is it a Peter Greenaway film if people don't walk out?
Maybe. I felt this film was more accessible than his last one that we showed. And this one's really interesting because it explores the life of the famous and infamous Russian filmmaker Sergei Einstein.
Yeah.
And what happened, or why he might have gone off track when he went to Mexico to make this amazing film that never got made. And, I mean, there is a film from the footage that he shot, but it's not the film that he actually intended to make because it was taken away from him. And
not to get off topic, because I know I want to hear more of what your personal picks are, but you're showing some of that footage, aren't you?
We are showing the Viva Mexico as well, so you can sort of see that.
Is that piggybacked along with this screening that you're talking about?
It's within the same weekend.
Okay.
So it's two separate programs. Another film that you may have heard about that I'm most excited about is Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, which won the Audience Award at Sundance as well as a Grand Jury Prize, which often doesn't happen. Usually the Grand Jury Prize is something that no one ever hears about again, and then the Audience Award is something that's a little bit more mass appeal. But it's been likened to Fault in Our Stars, but a smarter Fault in Our Stars. And it's
a good?
And that's, yes.
Hey, I actually like
Fault in Our Stars. Yes.
There you go.
Okay, we've got room divided on that one.
I'm not a fan.
I'm in the middle, but the thing is about this film, it has... I liken to also like a great Warner Brothers Looney Tune cartoon, in that there's all these amazing references that some people may not get, but if you're a film lover, there's so many great film references throughout the film that just adds to and enhances the story. But it is also a tearjerker. It is a coming of age teenage film, but it's brilliant, and it's from a director that I'm definitely wanting to see more of what he has done. Although his first film, they're not listing it what his first one was, because it was a horror movie, a genre horror movie that he made.
Hmm. One of the things I really love that you guys do, and I know you do it year round, but you kind of really put an emphasis during the festival, is showing older stuff. I'm really, really pumped to see this director's cut of 54, a movie that was kind of famously supposed to be involved in Oscars and awards season kind of stuff, and just kind of came out and pretty much forgotten by everybody. And then this director's cut emerged all of a sudden, and it's maybe a forgotten classic.
It's interesting. The process of making 54 really, in many ways, destroyed Mark Christopher's career from where he went, from the trajectory of being a rising, talented director. It really put a number on him. And we had shown all of his films at the festival, all of his short films, and so we're really excited about this. So we had a great relationship, and I heard a lot from him personally about what had happened. And he even gave me a VHS cassette of this director's cut that he wanted to, make, and it's a completely different film. And I still have that VHS cassette. I was supposed to give it back to him. And
this is sort of like Hordosky's Dune or something like that.
Something along those lines, yeah.
But finally, with a new regime controlling the Miramax library, he was able to get control and the possibility to actually make and put out the film that he intended to make. Because they made him shoot 40 additional minutes of footage. Neve Campbell became the star of the film when she was really a secondary character. So they completely changed the film. I mean, it's completely, it just completely changed it in terms of what he was trying to do. And then it flopped and they blamed him.
Those things.
Well, and there's a lot more Breckenmeyer. And his character is supposed to be a lot more complex. I'm really excited to see what happens there with that. And from what I understand, people who thought Mike Myers was genius the first time around are going to really think he's fantastic here.
Exactly. So it's Breckenmeyer, Mike Myers, and Ryan Philippe. And hopefully we'll get one of them to come to the screening at the festival.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Mark Christopher will be here. And the fun part is we're creating something where you can not only see the film, but you can experience it. We're going to recreate and turn the Neptune Theater into Club Studio 54 for one night.
Will there be cocaine?
Yes.
Little silver spoons.
That's the famous. That's the famous. Yeah. Hey, I'm getting a look at from the producer like cocaine. I'm just saying that was a famous part of Studio 54.
There will not be any as far as I know.
Okay.
It's always interesting to me, though, with Sif, the balance you get between, your opening night film is Spy. Yes. You could not get a more high-profile, studio-driven comedy to open your festival. You've got Inside Out playing. You've got some really high-profile studio films. But then you mix that, like you said, with your first film ever from...
Mauritius. And I might be saying that wrong, but that's how I say it.
These little films that this might be the only opportunity we ever get to see them, sadly. How do you do that, and why do you do that?
Well, we love, and I personally love all kinds of films.
Yeah.
I love a big studio film, even though I'm probably not going to see the new Avengers film. But Star Wars. I'll wait for Star Wars. I like all kinds of cinema, so whether it's genre, whether it's experimental. There's so many different things that we're showing that highlights sort of the whole spectrum of what cinema can be. I love comedy, so there's great comedies. There's great comedies from France. There's a very politically incorrect comedy from France, I Kissed a Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a gay man who's about to get married to his boyfriend, and he wakes up with a woman one day, and it completely changes the perspective of life, and it's everyone is so upset that he's not getting married to his boyfriend. But it's not really politically correct. It's not the story you expect to see when we're fighting about gay marriage and everything else in the United States. But so no one's shown it in the U.S. yet, but we're going to show it.
And then closing out the festival as well, looks like it's going to be something kind of interesting involving Jason Schwartzman, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Jason Schwartzman is in two films. He's in a character piece, which is really about him and his dog wandering around Austin for 75 minutes called Seven Chinese Brothers. And then the closing night film, The Overnight, is from Patrick Bryce, who formerly had made a horror film called Creep.
Yep.
Is this the one with Adam Scott?
This is with Adam Scott, Jason Schwartzman, and it revolves around a Seattle couple. They go to Los Angeles and meet another couple, and as part of that, they get invited over for dinner, and the things just start getting crazy, and they wonder whether this is what all Californians do when you get invited for over to dinner.
I know we're kind of starting to run a little bit out of time here, but I got to ask you, is there something about bacon this year?
Is there something about bacon?
There is. Explain. Kevin Bacon will be coming to the film festival. Oop. Love him. We will be showing Footloose and Diner. He's in a new film, which is fantastic. It is called Cop Car.
Ah.
Cop Car is this great film where two truant sort of, kids that are getting a lot of trouble, they find an empty cop car and they steal it. But they just don't know that the cop is actually down the way burying a body, and there's another body in the trunk.
That sounds amazing.
So the corrupt cop played by Kevin Bacon, spends the entire movie trying to get his cop car back, and the kids are having a great time with it. And then it actually is more of a midnight movie. It's more of a neo-noir thriller, but it's amazing, and he's great. And it really shows his range. And the thing is that he took Footloose, and he catapulted him to a huge fame, but then he took so many different interesting roles, and what he's doing in TV and film over the course of his career is something that we should definitely look at.
So if he's going to be here, though, do we still get to play the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game if we're all
going to
be 1 degree away?
Or I was going to say, in the day of Vine videos, where it's a 10-second clip or a 3-second clip, we could all run up, stand next to Kevin, say, ah, la, 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 and then, hey, we've been in a film with Kevin Bacon, because now it's this Vine video. I know. I'm wondering if this is going to happen.
My knowledge of Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver's secret history made me the nerd. Mm-hmm. Apparently not. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Footloose, one other thing I'll say is that Sam Elliott will be here. And of course, we're not showing Roadhouse, but that's a film that I always love when I think of Sam Elliott.
If I get the chance to meet Sam Elliott, I'm just going to sit there and just say, here's a phone book. Just read. I just want to hear your voice. That's all I want to do. I just want to hear him talk. That's all I want to hear. So that being the case, SIFF begins May 14th, just
2 weeks.
International
the
Film
Gala
Festival.
In 2 weeks.
May 14th opens with Spy. You can get all the information and details you want at SIFF.net. That includes the box office. So if folks wanted to get their tickets in advance or if they wanted to attend the opening night gala, that's where they're going to find it.
SIFF.net.
Anything selling hot right now that you know of?
Tickets just went on sale today. So opening night is selling quite well. And Kevin Bacon, I think, is actually going to be a hot seller.
Nice.
Fantastic. This is Cinema Squabble. You can find us at cinemasquabble.com. You can find us on iTunes as well. And just a quick review of what we've talked about this evening. Adult Beginners getting 2 in the theater, 1 in the rent category. Clouds of Sils Maria getting 3 in the theater, 1 in the rent category. And Avengers splitting the house. We've got 2 in the theater, 2 in the rental category. Sarah, you're looking at me saying...
Oh, I just want to put a quick plug out there. The Translations Film Festival starts this weekend. It's Seattle's only transgender film festival.
Ah.
It's going to be up at the Northwest Film Forum. Go, 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 go.
If you don't do that, come see Tangerine, which we're co-presenting with them, which is an amazing, amazing film.
Can't wait to see that.
Okay, so Tangerine at the Egyptian, one to mark on the calendar as well. Carl Spence, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carl. Yeah,
thank you. Once again, you can find us at cinemasquabble.com. Thank you very much for Sprint's Arbogast, our producer, and to Squawking Vulture Studios for post-production on this production.